Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name's Noah.
And I'm Emily. And today we have Luke Busta, who is a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and he is studying plant chemistry. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be here.
So I was really interested in your work because you study a lot about phytochemicals. And I'm really interested in phytochemicals, and I don't think a lot of people maybe know what they are or like the potential exciting value that a lot of them hold. So could you just tell us like what is a phytochemical and then sort of how you got into studying them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. So yeah, phytochemical. So the word phytochemical, as you can sort of already tell, it's two parts, phyto, which is plant, and chemical, which is obviously chemical. So these are plant chemicals, chemicals that are derived from plants. And when we use the word phytochemicals, oftentimes we are referring to chemicals that are unique to a particular plant species or a particular family of plants. So perhaps you've heard people say things like, oh, we're all big bags of chemicals or something like this. So basically everything, it's true, everything is made up of chemicals. And if you look at all the different species that are, you know, present in the world, or, you know, we're talking about plants, if you look at all the different plant species, for example, they all have some things in common. So we've all got DNA, we've all got RNA, we've all got proteins and nucleic acids and amino acids and all this kind of stuff. These are all what we would call like core metabolic components. So they're like chemicals that are necessary for like the very fundamentals of life. And so when we talk about phytochemicals, oftentimes we're talking about there are things that don't fall into that realm. So there are things that are unique to a particular plant species. And basically, the way I usually try to think about it or try to explain it is that, you know, when you're an animal, if you're like we are, when you're challenged with something, we can usually solve our problems by moving around. So if we're hungry, we can like go get food, or if we're being attacked by, you know, I mean, maybe we're not being attacked by predators so much these days anymore, at least hopefully not. But certainly back in the day, right, if you're being attacked by a predator, you can escape with movement. So plants, at least certainly relative to animals, don't have this luxury. And so they have developed ways of dealing with all their challenges that are largely chemical in nature. And because each plant lives in a specific environment, the chemical responses to all these challenges are also environment and therefore species specific. And so, you know, if you've got a plant that's being challenged by a particular insect, it probably has some sort of phytochemical defense that's specific for that insect that other species don't have. So this is sort of what I generally try to explain or think about when we're talking about phytochemicals. And I think you also asked how I got interested in them, maybe?
Yeah, how did you start studying plants? Your work in phytochemicals started with an interest in plants and chemistry, probably, right?
Yeah, you totally hit it on the head. So ever since I was a little kid, I've been fascinated by plants. My mom tells this story of going out to her garden one day and seeing like me as a little kid in the garden covered in red, like red all over my face. And she's like, oh my gosh, what is this? And looked, it turns out I'm sitting next to the tomato plant and had just eaten all the tomatoes off the plant, the cherry tomatoes that she had been working on growing. So ever since I was a little kid, I was fascinated by these things. And I had also then later a really good high school chemistry teacher. And that just sort of like inspired me to, oh, okay, chemistry, this is interesting, and I can do this. And so I went and then studied chemistry during my undergrad studies and had a very good biochemistry professor there. And I thought, well, maybe I can put like this sort of this passion for plants and this passion for chemistry together, and then pursued a PhD in that sort of combination discipline. And that's sort of how it all got started. And it just, yeah, it hasn't really stopped. It's been, there haven't been any major problems, so I haven't abandoned the dream yet.
Good. That sounds great. So you mentioned that phytochemicals, like in terms of plants, right, they're a lot of times used as a defense mechanism. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the major, these sort of like phytochemicals, these species, like unique to a particular species or a particular plant family chemicals, they serve all different kinds of roles for the plant. But one major one, and one that's really easy to understand a lot of times, is the defense compound role. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's quite quite a straightforward relationship those cases can be. But they do other things as well, you know, like some they use to harvest light, some are used to attract pollinators, some are used to interact with the soil microbiome, things like this.
Are there any phytochemicals that the average person would already sort of be aware of by name, or are these strictly in the hallowed halls of long Latin phrases? What's a sort of familiar plant defense chemical?
I think one that everybody knows, I'm not really sure if you would call it defense or not. Have you heard of capsaicin, for example? Certainly. This is like the thing that makes peppers spicy.
Oh, right? Certainly. And the, okay. The colloquial knowledge is that is used to fend off insects. Is that true?
Yeah, so I think it, okay, yeah, so maybe I made it sound like it was really simple earlier. Like, basically the role of plant chemicals in a plant's environment are, maybe in some cases it's easy to measure some sort of relationship, but that doesn't mean that's it's the only thing it does. So I don't know if capsaicin can ward away insects. Maybe it does, but I know the leading hypothesis for what it does has a bit more to do with this really important challenge that plants face, which is spreading their seeds around. Mm-hmm. So if that, you know, like plants, you know, if they need to migrate or something, they can't, you know, follow the buffalo or whatever. They need to do something different. They like spread by seeds. And this is why plants have, you know, seeds that can kind of get caught in the wind, like dandelions and things like this. Mm-hmm. But of course, another way that plants can spread their seeds is for an animal or an insect or a bird to pick up the seed in one way or another, whether it sticks to their fur or whether they ingest it, and then that seed gets taken very far away, and now the plant population is migrating. So I think capsaicin, the leading hypothesis is that it plays a role in this, and it's actually really fascinating. The idea is that the seeds of the pepper plant are, you know, what the plant really would prefer to happen is for a bird to eat the seed, because bird will take the seed the furthest. Mm-hmm. If, for example, a mammal eats the seed, mammals, we often have molars, and we might like demolish the seed or make it inviable so that when we pass it, the seed isn't going to germinate and turn into a new pepper plant or a new population of pepper plants or whatever. So the idea is that the capsaicin, it interacts with a mammalian-specific taste receptor. And so the seeds taste spicy to us, which is meant to be like a deterrent. Like the mammals are not supposed to enjoy that. They don't want to eat the pepper seeds. Whereas birds do not have these taste receptors. So they can eat the seeds. They don't have molars, so the seeds don't get crushed. They take the seeds far away, pass them, and then a new population can spring up in this distant location. Mm. I think this is the current idea of what one of the roles of capsaicin is.
Wow.
That was very well said. The other one that I think of is resveratrol. I don't know. I think
terms
of like wine, because at Davis there's a lot of wine people, and I think that one is pretty also well known, just because also people know wine. And I have also heard that can play a role in plant defense, but is also potentially has health benefits, like human health benefits.
It's super interesting. I mean, I think there's been a fair amount of excitement about resveratrol and a fair amount of research done on it. I don't know what the current sort of thinking in that area is, but it's definitely an interesting type of molecule and something that people have heard of. If we're talking beverages and phytochemicals, though, I mean, you know, caffeine is also a phytochemical.
Yep.
Fun fact, caffeine has evolved several different times throughout the plant kingdom. So the, you know, caffeine in the coffee plant and caffeine in the tea plant, that the ability of those two different plants to make caffeine, that ability was not inherited from a common ancestor of those two species. That ability was developed independently. Hmm. And the same is true for cocoa. So all three of those sort of came up with that independently.
Yeah, I think that may even be much more familiar to the average person than capsaicin or resveratrol.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, as scientists, yeah, I guess we don't necessarily think of the most common one first.
Right.
I also have a master's in nutrition, so I come at phytochemicals from like a nutrition and health point of view. So from a plant, so they kind of intersect, I would say, the fields of nutrition and plant science. Because there's a lot of interest now in the human health effects of them, because a lot of antioxidants are phytochemicals, and they're thought to have anti-inflammatory properties as well.
Yeah, I mean, It makes total sense. I mean, I guess the other thing that comes to mind when you bring it up to me is that one of the things that we're doing right now in our field, one of the things we're interested in is discovering, I don't even know if discovering is the right word. One of the things that we're interested in is understanding more about, the various healing properties that plants have. And of course, people have known about these things for a super long time. All kinds of traditional medicine systems have, large amounts of knowledge about, what plants are good for what sort of thing and so on. And so one of the things that people are doing a lot now is going into the traditional medicine literature and finding, this plant and this particular medicinal property, and then digging down, chemically speaking, into the basis for that activity. Yeah, it's really interesting. And, more often than not, as far as I can tell, there generally is something to be found in those types of studies. Yeah.
It's just that in the traditional medicine kind of stuff, there hasn't been a lot of chemistry research, but you're saying in general that you find validity in some of those traditional medicine.
Yeah, validity and complexity. I mean, a lot of times the extract from the plant is a cocktail, right? And, we know from pure medicinal chemistry learning that oftentimes there can be synergistic effects. And so whether or not the cocktail of compounds coming from a plant extract are able to provide sort of a synergistic, healing or medicinal property or something like this, it is something that people look into a fair amount as well.
Yeah, and I want to remind people that, before the current era of synthetic chemical research for pharmaceuticals, a lot of the medicines that we might know and trust and have some special brand name, those came from plant-derived sources originally. So people should be familiar with at least the sort of end result of what they might otherwise think is a very complicated process that probably came from plant extracts.
I mean, even some of the ones we still take today. So,
sure.
Last night was, last night a lot of people were celebrating Valentine's Day, mm-hmm. perhaps with some drinks. Mm-hmm. And so when you wake up in the morning and you have a headache, you take, aspirin or something like this. Mm-hmm. So aspirin is actually a drug that is like directly derived from a plant. And I need to remember here what the, So aspirin is acetyl salicylic acid. And salicylic acid is a plant hormone, and so it's just one simple sort of acetylation reaction, the addition of two carbons and an oxygen that convert it from this plant hormone into this medicine that many of us perhaps took this morning.
Yeah, I could also be wrong. That's the main ingredient in a lot of acne treatments as well.
Oh, really?
Salicylic acid, yeah. I should Google that, but I remember that from childhood.
Yeah,
and one again, the problem seems to be that once we get into the chemical names, suddenly I think the average person recoils from the complexity and thinks, okay, I know what aspirin is, I know what Advil is, I know these brand names, I know the concept here, I know why I'm taking it, but actually thinking back those two or three steps to say, okay, this compound came from a plant, that's a process maybe the average person hasn't done before.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I hadn't. Until I started getting into this sort of thing. I guess one of the things that really got me going on some of the popular phytochemicals, a few years ago, I started I do a weekly Twitter post about a new phytochemical every Friday. It's mm-hmm. called Phytochemical Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun and I've learned so much. For example, this story we just told about aspirin or something like this. I don't know if I've done resveratrol. Maybe I should make a note and do that one. But there's a can of worms maybe. This is where I began to learn about a bunch of these. And it's actually, I think we know a lot more of them than we think. When we think of, for example, tonic water.
Yeah.
I think maybe some people have heard that tonic water has quinine in it. Right, so quinine is the name of an alkaloid that is a very pretty effective anti-malaria drug. But anyway, we drink it in our club soda or whatever mixed drinks we're making, and all sorts of things. Or the cumin, like the curcumin in your
curcumin.
Spice cabinet. This the cumin contains massive amounts of this fluorescent compound called curcumin, and another phytochemical that I think probably a lot of us have eaten.
Yeah, and that's certainly gotten a lot of recent press for being anti-inflammatory. And in fact, we've stumbled upon something that I take myself because it's pretty darn effective. But in the overall space of media, that's gotten a lot of press recently, believe it or not.
Do you take it in your coffee?
No, I take huge amounts of it just in pill form because it's like really darn effective and it's pretty organically, naturally sourced.
Yeah, absolutely. Does that work for you?
It actually really does. And I've compared it to synthetic stuff that really didn't. I did a lot of my own sort of trials on this. And it takes a huge dose. It takes a dose that you would never get just from taking turmeric or taking cumin. So you have to take it with this separate extract because it's like 90 times more concentrated.
Oh, got it. This is like a curcumin pill, not like powdered turmeric. Root.
And what's interesting is that you have to, let's say you're buying this from a store, you could go through 30 different bottles and brands of this thing, and only one or two of them would have, I would call, a medically active dose of the actual extract. The rest of it is just a powdered form of the spice extract, which you could get in the spice aisle of the grocery store. It's really interesting. And people aren't paying attention to those varieties. Yeah.
There's some threshold that needs to be met?
I think it's a matter of what ends up being processed by the body quickly enough. So your body will just respond really, really quickly to the small amounts that are in just the spice normally. I think I did some really quick napkin math. You'd have to intake like 30 pounds of turmeric powder to get the same amount of the extract as is one pill. So nobody's taking the amount just from the powder, although obviously people claim benefits from these things, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's a great spice. I'm sure it has a very, very small effect, but for a lot of things to get measurable, they have to be concentrated down more, and that has to happen and then be honestly portrayed in the labeling, which is huge. Definitely.
So do you do this Phytochemical Friday on Twitter, and your Twitter handle is Plants Are Chemists, which I like a lot.
Thanks. Yeah, Plants Are Chemists, just the R is just an R.
Yeah, I'll link people to it. But this is just from my experience, too. It seems like Twitter is like a pretty big social media platform in science, and I don't really know why. Like, how did you get into Twitter, and do you think it's a useful tool for science communication?
It's a great question. I had a friend, she's still my friend. I have a friend, and she runs a blog about mosses. It's called Moss, Plants, and More. And she found, I read her blog and I thought it was an interesting blog. And I thought, you know what, I was looking around for blogs about phytochemistry.
Yeah.
And there wasn't really that much out there. There were phytochemistry posts that would pop up on food blogs or maybe on botany blogs or things like this. Yeah. You could find posts here and there, but there was nothing dedicated to it. So I thought, you know what, god darn it, I'm going to start a blog on plant chemicals. And so I started this blog and I wrote, you know, I don't know, maybe like page long entries every month was my goal. And I did this for, I don't know, a year or something. And I felt like it wasn't getting very much attention, and maybe a year wasn't long enough. Maybe I needed to do it longer than that. But I thought, you know what, it's a lot of work to write these like one pagers and, you know, have little interesting stories about, you know, whatever the topic is and so on. And I thought maybe I should like try shorter, quicker installments. And so I thought, you know, I hear my friends talking about Twitter. I should bite the bullet and try that out. And so I got on Twitter and I started doing the weekly posts. And those, I felt like, much more quickly got a lot of traction and led to a much more sort of discussion than would the full-length blog posts. So now the blog just contains, once a month I update it, but it's just a compendium of that month's Twitter posts. And so all the new content is every week on Twitter. And so that's how I got started doing that. And yeah, like I said, it's led to a lot more interaction between, you know, between me and other people, or between other people or whatever, you know, which is, of course, one of the goals, is just to prompt discussion and things like this. So I felt like it was effective in that way. But of course, then being on Twitter, you know, you have access to all other variety of conversations that are going on. So yeah, there's all kinds of conversations going on there. I found that by being very deliberate about who I followed and whose posts I allowed to appear in my feed. By being very restrictive about that, I've been able to keep my feed pretty focused on what I want it to be focused on. So I like to use Twitter for science, essentially, and my sort of professional life. And so I don't, if people post things about, you know, their families or about politics or about what they were up to that weekend, I think that's fine, of course, but I generally mute that person. And so I've found that it's been pretty nice. I can keep my feed sort of focused on science, interesting facts, pretty pictures of plants, things like that. So it's a pleasant place for me at the moment. But the other thing that I get a lot of on there that I do like is there's a lot of information about careers in science on Twitter, and whether that has to do with sort of just being a graduate student or a sort of a postdoc or a young professor, or whether it has to do with trying to find jobs in industry, particularly in chemistry. There are a few accounts that I follow that have lots of information about that type of pursuit. And it's been sort of eye-opening to see all these different things and see some of the camaraderie that gets built through the various conversations in these different areas.
Yeah, I think that's particularly interesting that that you said on Twitter you get more discussion from people, which is kind of seems counterintuitive to me because the posts are shorter, right? But it actually engages more people and has more, which I think is good. I guess because the ultimate goal really is to engage people in that discussion. As a PhD student at Davis, Twitter is such a much bigger platform in science than I ever realized. So I'm not really sure how scientists got really into Twitter, but it does seem to be like a good platform for scientists in general, from my experience as well.
Yeah, it has this kind of, at least in my experience, this kind of casual vibe that isn't found in other sort of scientific venues as frequently. And there's a bit of not anonymity, but I don't know. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that a lot of times I see people asking pretty frank questions that are good questions about, like, I experienced this. Is this normal? Someone told me this. That to me seemed unacceptable. Do you agree? Or, you know, I've received a job offer. You know, is this a suitable amount for me to counter their offer with? So some pretty frank discussion about things that I think are normal questions that scientists have, that if they don't have the fortune of having a variety of good mentors in their life, it seems like they're putting those questions out there to a larger group and is, you know, often receiving what to me seem to be pretty good answers. And, you know, that's definitely a positive thing, I feel like.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of communities out there online. I know the science subsection of Reddit is another one with some pretty darn authoritative content there, and the ability for people to ask perhaps questions that wouldn't appear other places. But there's certainly no guarantee that a social media platform will ever become a scientific hotbed and one with any sort of serious discussion going on. So it's rather lucky that we have two of them, and certainly Twitter is perhaps even more surprising as short form. You wouldn't really associate with rigorous scientific inquiry of any kind, but it's great. It can be. It certainly should be. And I bet the short form is encouraging people to really get to the meat of an issue, of a question, right? It has to be this reduced amount of text or a picture or something. So if you're not really getting to the point, it gets lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, I definitely see it as sort of a repository of bridges to more in-depth information.
Sure.
You know, here's a link to the full article. Yeah. Here's the prettiest figure from the article to get you hooked in there. Or at least that's what gets me hooked most mornings. You know, it's like, wow, look at all that figure has so much nice color in it. I better see what that paper's about. You know, and then go off to the journal website or something. But yeah, I think it sort of like opens lots of doors, just as you said, and provides opportunity for more in-depth discussion or more in-depth investigation that one could carry out on their own.
Certainly. I mean, have you found pretty significant research that you wouldn't have otherwise have found through Twitter?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, wow. I think that statement needs to be qualified a little bit. Like, basically, if I haven't, you know, for like the my particular field and the things that are immediately relevant to me as far as things I need to be aware of mm-hmm. for my own research, mm-hmm. those things I generally don't stumble upon on right. Twitter. Those things right. show up in like the Google Scholar alerts and mm-hmm. various other types of alerts and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I do find things that I would not have otherwise found because they're sort of tangentially relevant. So they don't show up in my literature searches or something like that, but they, you know, a friend of mine or a colleague would say, wow, check out this great paper or whatever. And this happens most often with botany papers. I have I'm really fascinated by botany, and I don't really do botany, and so I don't really have a finger in that literature at all, but it crops up on the Twitter feed. And so I say, oh my gosh, they discovered a new species, or they found a new crazy way that this plant reproduces, or oh, they sequenced a genome from the first ever whatever type of plant, and I had no idea that was even a thing. And that, you know, so in that way I find new papers on there and learn things that I would not have otherwise learned from a technical standpoint. Yeah.
So I would just like to go back a little bit to phytochemicals and maybe a little bit more about your research. So like, how do you and or scientists in general like study these phytochemicals?
Yeah, that's okay. Great question. Yeah, there's a lot of different things we can talk about here. So I mean, basically anything you can think about for these chemicals, for these particular types of chemicals, anything, any sort of question you can imagine about them, there's probably somebody who at the very least has the same question and might be actively working on answering that question. And so things like, what is their function for the plant? You know, we discussed, mm-hmm. oh, there's capsaicin, and it has, you know, maybe this function of trying to get birds to eat it as opposed to mammals and so on. So what is the function of the chemical for the plant is one thing that people are looking into. Another thing is, of course, what is the function of that, you know, especially if it's a plant that we eat, what is the function of those phytochemicals that we're consuming in our bodies? What are they doing? And then that question, of course, can be unpacked into, you know, what you were talking about earlier, Noah, with dosages. And, you know, if we eat a little bit of this versus a lot of this, is there a difference and so on? People are looking into that. Another thing that, and something that I'm particularly passionate about, is understanding the genetic basis for how a lot of these chemicals are made. So we know that, I mentioned earlier that all organisms have DNA, so plants have DNA, and this is essentially a set of instructions that can be used to sort of carry out different processes. And one of the processes, of course, that the plant carries out is creating these phytochemicals. And so one of the things that people are working on, myself included, is understanding how the DNA encodes those instructions. Create quinine. What do those instructions look like? How do we recognize them, both in species that produce quinine, or how could we, you know, then recognize it in other species that perhaps produce quinine but we don't know about it, or something like this. So how do the chemicals get made in the first place is another thing that people work on a lot. And then I think one of the bigger ones that a lot of people think about, whether or not they work on it, or at least I hope they should be thinking about it, is how these chemicals came to be in the first place. Like, why are they here? How did they evolve? Like, how do you get the assembly of this giant, like, 50 carbon crazy molecule with 20 stereocenters and weird little nooks and crannies and all these bridges linking together different portions of the molecule? Like, how does that even come to be in the first place? This is a question that I think people are slowly working on, that we're beginning to have some understanding about.
Great. Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about that last one, like the evolutionary basis kind of phytochemicals, is that
yeah saying? Yeah, that's exactly
that's
it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it strikes me a lot like how we investigate evolutionary history of animals, of space, of all sorts of things. I mean, we're looking at how the most complex form came to be, and that involves figuring out how it started in the simplest sense, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean there's all sorts of these are still all open questions, right? So all the things that we're about to say in our discussion about it are all sort of what we currently think is happening, or one thing that people think is happening, and maybe we could be totally wrong, but
science,
these are sort of our
general,
best ideas. Yeah, science in general, right? It's like, well, we think this is going on, but we're going to try and be as accurate as possible, and so we're going to qualify every statement we make. But yes, that's basically it, is this sort of slow incremental change over many millions of years.
Yeah. There's so many different kinds of phytochemicals. I looked it up before. It says there are so far about 4,000 phytochemicals that have been identified. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are a lot of things we still don't know about phytochemicals, as you said. So far, though, I think they've been used a lot for medicinal purposes, as we touched on before, but then also some of them can be, also kind of touched on this, I guess, too, that some of them can be toxic at certain doses and the balance there. I think, though, in terms of the pharmaceutical industry, a lot of, in the past, like, we use a lot of these phytochemicals in their natural form as drugs, as medicinal products, and then we have started to, like, alter them on a chemical level to kind of improve them.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an interesting idea. Like, do you think that maybe we should be continuing to alter them, or maybe, like, are a lot of these phytochemicals in their natural state really beneficial as well?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great question. Yeah. So I think the thing to understand first is that each phytochemical has, like, a unique molecular structure. So, you know, phytochemicals are, like, all molecules. They're made up of atoms. There's many different kinds of atoms, carbon and hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and so on. Mm-hmm. And all these different little atoms are, for each phytochemical, linked up in a very unique way. And so you've got this unique little arrangement of atoms that make up a phytochemical. And then now, of course, as you just said, there can be lots of different little subtle modifications to, like, a general kind of molecular structure. So if you've got this molecule and it's got, let's say it's got three rings in it. And so you can have the three rings, but maybe there's a subtle variant found in the same plant species where it not only has the three rings, but one of the three rings has an extra oxygen molecule on it, oxygen atom or something like this. And so you can imagine then there's a third variant where there's two additional little oxygen atoms on the side, but overall it kind of looks the same. So we have all these, like, variations on a theme, essentially. Mm-hmm. And yeah, as you said, one of the things that we do in, well, one of the things that people are doing when they're doing medicinal chemistry is they make many, actually hundreds of variations on a theme of a molecule, trying to find which one is the most effective for a particular reason, whether it be to block a particular metabolic pathway that is going haywire in some sort of syndrome or something like this, or whatever they're trying to do. And so when we isolate a phytochemical, there are sort of two things that I sort of imagine are generally happening. One thing is we're isolating sort of one example of a whole host of related things. We got one of them. And then oftentimes, various, we call them derivatives. These are, like, sort of the related structures. Various derivatives of them are made and used for testing or something like this. But I think one thing that we don't think about so much is that oftentimes, and this sort of ties back to the evolutionary thing we were talking about earlier, is that one of the things that we find most when we analyze the phytochemicals of a particular plant, I'll give an example here to try and make this a bit more concrete. So I've worked some on the carrot plant, Daucus carota. This is, like, the orange carrot that you buy at the supermarket. It makes these kind of funny chemicals that we call polyacetylenes. These are, like, they're sort of like fatty acids, kind of. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the point is it makes, you know, maybe like 20 different polyacetylenes. They're all, like, very closely related, but they have these subtle differences between them. And so it's got, you know, so when we like, there's one of them that's quite famous, and people have, like, isolated it and found that, oh yes, it can kill cancer cells and so on and things like this. But I think one thing that hasn't been studied quite as much is the other 19 or so that the plant makes. Yeah. There's all these, like, different sort of relatives. What do they do? Do they also, are they also able to kill cancer cells? Are they active against different types of cancer and so on? So there's this question which relates to all these, you know, different variants that you mentioned. And this, of course, ties into the evolutionary aspects as well, because, you know, what is the plant doing? Well, the plant is trying to have some sort of weapon ready to go at any one time if it's attacked by a new pathogen. And so we know that one of the main things these carrot molecules, these polyacetylenes, are doing is protecting the plant against fungal attack in the soil. So if there's a fungus living in the soil and it attacks the carrot, the outside of the carrot, like it's called the periderm, but it's like the epidermis of the root, right? This is the outermost layer of sort of skin, so to say. That is the location where these compounds are located. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing the fungus encounters when it attacks the carrot are these polyacetylenes. And so you can imagine that if it's got 20 different varieties, one of those should be pretty effective against any particular fungus. And so, okay, there's one fungus attack, fungus A comes in and gets thwarted by, you know, a particular type of polyacetylene. Then fungus B comes in, and that same type of polyacetylene isn't very effective against it, but a different type is. And so by having this whole cocktail of relative or of related molecules, the plant can sort of serve its purpose. And this, of course, then leads to evolution, right? So if you've got a population of these carrots living in the wild, they have these different polyacetylenes. If there's a particular challenge, like a new type of fungus comes in, that might lead to selective pressure for a particular type of polyacetylene. The carrot individuals that have a lot of that one will survive and reproduce and so on. Mm-hmm. And now the population over time will change to favor that particular member of the group of polyacetylenes. And this then is leading to changes in the chemical profile and elaborations in terms of the assembling of these molecules, and they can slowly begin to be more complex and more specialized for particular challenges they face. So all this is sort of tied together, the evolutionary aspect and the medicinal aspect, but sort of this underlying theme of what you started this whole business with, which was that there's like many variations on a theme, just like medicinal chemists are doing when they synthesize a compound. They make hundreds of different varieties and are of sort of subtle modifications and test them all. The plant is doing the exact same thing of its own accord out in the wild in nature to solve its own problems. And so I think it's maybe that says we're doing something right by making all these derivatives, right? If nature is using that same sort of pathway to explore its various options, I don't know. But it's definitely fascinating.
That's a unique perspective. I never really thought about that way, that medicinal chemistry is kind of doing what the plant is doing naturally.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly so early in all this that it's challenging to say what works and what doesn't, even from a safety perspective. I think most people's gripe with it right now, if they are speaking from an educated perspective, is that we're doing something that nature specifically didn't try, and maybe there's a reason. Maybe somewhere in nature that some variant of this was going to happen and then didn't, and nature decided that wasn't a good idea. There can be reasons for that. And so when we create something that nature couldn't or wouldn't try, that's when there's maybe an issue. But it's the same technique, and there's no reason to think empirically it's the wrong approach. It's just very new.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree. There are definitely some in the chemical realm. There are some tools that we have access to that nature does not have as easy of access to. And so I think there are some things that we would try if we were making a new drug, for example, based on one of these phytochemicals. There are some things that we might try that nature might not have tried simply because it was, evolution is a random walk, right? And maybe either that particular outcome never came to pass,
right,
or the likelihood of it coming to pass is extremely small. And had it come to pass, it would have stayed, or it would have been fixed. It would have stayed, right? It would have continued on. But there are particular chemical reactions that nature has a hard time accessing, I think.
That's super interesting. Yeah, I mean, I guess this is just a fascinating topic to me, sort of. The whole like natural thing, like the whole natural and chemicals, and I don't know, I sometimes feel like defensive sometimes, I think, when people are like, oh, you're changing the chemical structure of these molecules, like why shouldn't we just use them like the way nature intended us to, and so then there's this whole pushback of like pesticides and drugs, for example, like why shouldn't we just use like the natural ones, like the natural phytochemical versions of them? Why do we to alter them to make them better? So I guess that's just kind of a topic that I find interesting, like at what point are we altering nature too much?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a complicated question, right? What's the best way to address this?
I know, that's a hard question.
Yeah. So if you can, just speak on basically what are the motivations here? Like you said a little bit, it's important to realize that nature is not doing anything on a time scale that we may even understand. I mean, it may be trying 100 variants of something that take 100 years each, and to us, it looks like no change has been made in the last century, right? So that certainly is relevant. But also, there's just all sorts of different things we have access to, and we're making drugs now with petrochemicals that would never have any other, you know, relevant, really access to sort of regular plant chemistry out in a field somewhere. So there's a lot of stuff that we're doing that's not necessarily what nature does at the same time scale or at the same location. And we can just do things in laboratories far, far simpler. So the question really becomes, okay, when is the right time to step in? And just because we can, should we?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess as far as phytochemicals are concerned and creating, you know, new derivatives of phytochemicals or synthesizing things that are phytochemical-like, as far as simply exploring what is possible and checking things out, curiosity-driven science, I mean, to me, I don't see any major downside of this. I think the downside comes when these things happen at scale, right? And so if there's something being produced and now we're going to release it into the environment for a particular reason, whether it be a pesticide or some other type of, you know, deterrent or a coating or use it in an industrial product that's going to end up in the water supply or whatever, you know, I think once things are at scale, it needs to be considered. But as far as in the laboratory, like, should we, you know, as I said, within the space of creating phytochemical variants or things that are phytochemical-like, I mean, definitely my ears are open to argument, but I don't really see a strong reason to get too concerned about, you know, what people may or may not be creating relative to what nature may or may not have done.
That's an excellent point. I think I was almost walking you toward the question of scale, because it, from a scientific perspective, certainly test everything. But there's a lot of things now where the motivation to do the new research is to implement it in a large, commercial, scalable way. Otherwise, why fund that research? So when that sort of happens, you're sort of worrying, okay, well, this isn't just being done for exploratory, you know, good science reasons. We're trying to solve a capitalist problem here with mm-hmm. good chemistry. So the very nature of it is scale. But there's certainly other applications where things are being done for more pure reasons.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. it definitely becomes like a political, financial, ethical issue. Mm-hmm. I just think it's an interesting topic, and I just wanted your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it does come to the question of scale, I mean, I don't know. It's a complex world, and to me, it really comes down to what different things are being balanced. You know, I mean, we talk about how we need to feed more people in the next 30 years than we ever have in the past, and that we need to do it without destroying our planet. So we need to have more food and more agriculture, perhaps. I mean, obviously there are issues with supply and distribution and so on, but I think I don't think anybody that has looked at the data would argue that we need to produce more food in the coming years, but we need to do it without, you know, destroying the environment. And so what types of things are in the balance here, and what types of things are things that we're willing to do to achieve that goal, and what types of risks do they come with? I mean, yeah, it's a complicated question, but no absolutist point of view is correct. I think pretty...
Certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly. We take that approach. Yeah, no, our goal is always to explore the issue so deeply that we figure out, okay, what's actually at stake here and what perspectives are in actual contrast. And that intrigues us because we want to know how it affects the world at large. Mm-hmm. Is there anything from your particular research that you've found that would sort of dramatically inform how the future of food is going to look?
You know, I don't know about from my research, like mine personally, mm-hmm. but from the field that I'm a part of, mm-hmm. so, you know, scientists, we sort of, I like to think that we operate as sort of these large cohorts, and this is for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is because when you look at the collective works of a large number of scientists, not only is it sort of easier to understand what is happening, what the goals are, what things have we learned, but also because it's easier to identify falsehoods, essentially. So, you know, science operates and should operate on a consensus basis. And so a single experiment done by a single person does not really tell us much. But if over 10 years you've got half a dozen people in half a dozen countries that perform similar experiments and have a similar answer, this, of course, carries more weight. So I like mm-hmm. to think about things from this sort of like slightly, you know, whatever, 1,000 foot perspective, let's say. So what are things that we have learned as a field that might tell us about what the future of our food would look like? I think that one thing that I had not thought about until somewhat recently is that we should be ready to eat a larger variety of food. And to eat some things that perhaps, you know, we don't really consider as part of our sort of normal kitchen contents at the moment. And so, you know, people, I think I'll talk about some examples that I see coming in the plant world. But to first put it into maybe sort of a context that someone understand, you know, they say, oh, yeah, in the future, everybody's going to eat crickets, right? Yeah. They're all going to eat insects, right? Yeah. So this is the... I have no idea if that's the case. I mean, I don't know if you've ever had crickets. They're actually really great. It's like sort of a funny little kind of like popcorn thing. The spicy ones, go for those capsaicin-laden ones.
There you go.
You can get closer to plants that way. But in the plant world, there are a variety of cereal or staple crops that are quite a bit more hardy than some of the ones that are really broadly grown right now. So right now, you know, we have a lot of corn and soybean, mm-hmm. and which is fine and good. But there are a lot of other crops that I think that we could be, that will be more widely cultivated in the future. I think one of the big ones that we see coming is sorghum. It's a mm-hmm. relative of corn that's particularly drought tolerant mm-hmm. and requires a lot less fertilizer. And I think that's something that we'll see a lot more of in the future. You can do a lot. You can do a lot of things with it. Well, it's gluten free. You can make flour out of it. You can pop it like popcorn. You can feed it to cows. You can turn it into biofuel, just like corn and things like this. So this is just one example. But I think there's I think we're going to see a lot more of this type of thing. And I think, you know, I think that's good. I think we should, you know, monoculture is efficient, but there is resilience and diversity.
Yeah, we tend to agree, but I think people are sort of at the receiving end of a lot of that science, and they're not really in a position to say, okay, well, I'm going to change the crop that I'm eating. I think that's mostly the purview of companies that are deciding what massive things get planted at truly massive scale. But that mm-hmm. is already pretty much a surprise to me. I'm intrigued by there being new possibilities. I think companies will change whenever it's profitable for them. But we could be doing a better job to plant things that that nature intended us to plant, I think, probably.
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely, right? Yeah. Like, we live in a world that, for better or worse, sort of money seems to run the show. But I think when I go to the grocery store, if I see a box of crackers, if I'm going to buy a box of crackers, and the box of crackers says, now made with flours from four different grains that I've never heard of, I think my point is, don't be afraid of that box of crackers. Yeah, that's maybe where we have minute amount of input into this
right.
sort mm-hmm. of business. Right. Yeah,
true. That's a great point.
Is there anything else you would like to discuss? We enjoyed this conversation very much.
Let's see, anything else I want to discuss? I should have like my, like, where's, should have like a list of little mission statement items that I like bring up. Let's see.
Had...
I'll I'll summarize. I mean, we kind of talked about phytochemicals in general, what they are, how do scientists study them, how can they be useful for food and pharmaceuticals, sort of some ethical issues around, I guess, biotechnology how they relate to, and then how they relate to sort of the food and agriculture and the future of food. And
Well, I was going to say, I guess if I had one more thing to say, it would be this. And I guess I'll just get straight to the point. There's a lot of discussion right now about GMOs, and there's lots of information about them floating around. There's lots of opinions about them floating around. I would encourage people to keep an open mind and to try and consider, as we were talking about before, consider all the different things that are sort of in the balance here. GMOs are a powerful tool, and that tool can be used for all sorts of things. Some people might see some of those things as very bad. Other people might see some of the things that they could be used for as good. I'm of the opinion that both of those things are true. And on the good end, one of the things that we could use this tool to do is to make our agricultural system a lot more environmentally friendly. And so if you're a person that really cares about our quality of water, that cares about the amount of fossil fuels that we use to create our food, those problems can be in part addressed by using GMOs. And in my opinion, it should be considered pretty seriously as viable tools for addressing those problems, and that the trade-off may be worth it. So I would encourage people to keep an open mind in that arena.
Thanks.
You know, I'm not saying that they're there are lots of problems too. I'm not saying that doesn't exist, but I care a lot about the environment and about our planet. I have a little kid, and this is something we think about a lot. And this is a tool that can help us solve some of our really big problems. So I think it cannot be rejected entirely without much thought.
Certainly. I think this comes up a lot on our podcast almost every episode because we have to think about this. But it's great to address it from that same almost contrary perspective, where it can be used to solve the very problem it's being blamed for. And it's about who controls it. It's about end of life water supply and plant supply issues. So in that regard, it can be definitely negative, but the actual safety factor for eating it is, of course, usually fine. I think one of the hero stories recently has been the Beyond Meat and the Impossible Burger. Specifically, Impossible Burger uses GMO soy, and that is to make a more delicious plant burger that uses 12 times less water and land resources. So immediate environmental positive impact with a GMO product.
I think really only scratching the tip of the iceberg as far as positive environmental impacts that can be brought about by using that technology.
Right.
Even outside the plant world, I mean, where did I read the other day that they had? Yeah, it was in your area, in the Bay Area.
Probably.
There's a company that has fish tissue culture, right? And so now you can grow fish meat in a petri dish, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can grow your fish fillet in a petri dish as opposed to having, the oceans, come on, we've like decimated those poor things. I'm happy to eat some GMO fish fillets grown in a petri dish for the sake of, Nemo and his father.
It's happening over the place. We've got bacon from mushrooms. We've got fish that's grown from. I think they're doing a fish out of mushroom culture as well. It's a bunch of different ways, but also growing the tissue.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
So another look into the future of food here, as you asked about earlier.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Good,
no,
good,
I just
good.
I just think your perspective on GMOs is very well said, and maybe just like as an example that I can think of how maybe phytochemicals can relate to food and GMOs would be like you said that you study like the genetics of phytochemicals, right, and how they're produced in plants. So could you potentially alter a gene to alter the amount of a phytochemical that had a plant defense or nutritional property?
Absolutely. This is one of the major pieces of rationale behind what we do. So I can give you an example of each of those. I talked about earlier that I was studying, have been studying carrot, this particular class of compounds that are called polyacetylenes that protect the carrot from the fungus. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, at the very beginning, we talked about how phytochemicals, one of their characteristics is that they are unique to a particular species or family, mm-hmm. plant family, right?
Yeah.
So if we've got, for example, potatoes that are being attacked by funguses and the potato crop is being decimated by funguses, one possibility, if we understand the genetic basis for some of these fungal defense chemicals, is that we could transfer the ability to defend against funguses from the carrot to the potato, for example. And so now we can have potatoes that have the same type of defenses. These defenses are found in nature already. We know that they're actually very healthy for us. This is why you shouldn't peel or boil your carrots. You should just eat those suckers raw.
Fantastic.
But anyways, this is an example of the plant defense, for example, right, in a very agricultural setting. But there are others too, right? So, this has been going on sort of for the past decade. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and others have been funding research into the so-called golden rice,
yeah.
right? And a variety of other golden crops. And the idea here is that vitamin A deficiency in infants and children can lead to blindness, and that there are regions of the world where that isn't unheard of. There are problems with vitamin A deficiency. And so engineering the genes that control vitamin A synthesis in the plant so that those plants have extra vitamin A, or so that those rice grains or cassava roots or whatever they are have extra vitamin A, so that those deficiencies are met as far as in the diets of the children and the places where those crops are grown and consumed. This is something that has been done, is being done, and is an example of a way in which we can solve some of our problems in, sort of a way that isn't, from my perspective, this is a pretty harmless way, right? The plant already produces some vitamin A. If we can have it produce more, suddenly we can have children that aren't blind. Sounds like a winner to me.
Yeah, and that's a great example of nutritional use of it. And I think even for like plant defense compounds, like you were saying before, potentially that could even reduce the use of some more harmful pesticides that we're
mm-hmm.
now using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's like an environmental example. Do you want to tell us again what your Twitter handle is and your blog? And
yeah, absolutely. So just search, it's all under sort of one brand name. It's Plants Are Chemist. Just put that into Google, whether the R is A-R-E or just the letter R, it's all linked together. You'll find it. So Plants Are Chemists is the brand. And on Twitter, if you're looking for the hashtag, if you want to see all the various installments, it's hashtag Phytochemical Friday. And phytochemical is P-H-Y-T-O, chemical.
Good distinction.
Great.
And if there are any teachers or professors out there that are listening, or instructors or whoever, I have PowerPoint files that are all of the different Phytochemical Fridays. So it's like a picture of the chemical, a picture of the plant that it's from, and a picture of the product that it's used in, or the thing that we sort of know it from, as well as the little text blurb. I have those all saved. So if anybody wants all of those materials, they can feel free to contact me. I share them all the time. I know some people use them in their courses.
Excellent. Hopefully we can spread the education around. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, again, we wanted to thank you for being on the Evolutionese podcast, and hopefully we'll do this again sometime.
I would, yeah, it would sound great. It sounds like a fun topic. I have some, maybe we could come on with some friends. I have a friend that's an expert in traditional medicine. Maybe we could have a little joint chat sometime.
Absolutely possible.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you again.